Hello, and welcome to Baltic Ways, a podcast bringing you interviews and insights from the world of Baltic studies. I'm your host, Dr. Indra Ekmanis, and today we speak with Dr. Andrei Belli, an expert consultant on European and Russian energy policy. Dr. Belli has recently taught at University of Eastern Finland, University of Tartu, and today he speaks with us about the energy trilemma facing Europe and the Baltic states when it comes to decoupling from Russian energy: competitiveness, security, and climate targets. Stay tuned. Dr. Belli, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. To start, can you tell us a little bit about your background?
Thank you for hosting me. I am an energy policy consultant for about 20 plus years. I have worked and followed the European energy policies for quite a while, since basically the early 2000s. Like a small anecdote, when I started my PhD career back to the very early year 2000, some of the selection committee members were even reluctant about the topic because it sounded too odd and a little bit low-fashioned topic. So it proven to be totally opposite right few years after. But nobody would have expected that energy policy becomes such a hot topic, such a politicized issue. I also have about 7 years of working experience in Moscow. I worked at the Higher School of Economics, and some of my former colleagues are or have been related to the foreign policy advising, including all these developments that we are observing now. Frankly speaking, I have noticed a certain trend towards a revanchism in Russia, but I always believed that it was a rather marginal trend. However, it appeared to be a dominant one. So I have kind of insights from both Moscow and Brussels, but it happened to me to be in Estonia and to conduct my consultancy services from here. And among others, I have conducted some studies for the Estonian think tank on Estonian energy security. And now I am part of a broader European consortium which will work on the implementation of the EU diversification policy, the repower of Europe.
Well, thank you for sharing that background. It's so interesting to think that there was not so much interest in energy policy when it seems like this is the big topic today. So you are ahead of the game, I suppose, on that. Well, I wonder if you can set the stage a little bit for a non-specialist audience. What has the energy situation looked like in recent years in Europe and in the Baltic states in particular, vis-a-vis Russia?
It's quite a good and important question. When we look back in late 90s and early 2000s, a lot of interest existed in developing energy relations with Russia. And interdependencies have increased little by little. Let me give you an example. In the early 90s, because of a friendship, practically a personal friendship, between Lech Walesa, the former president of Poland, and Boris Yeltsin, the former president of Russia, the two presidents decided to build a new gas pipeline from Russia to Germany via Poland, which is now called Yamal Europe pipeline. In early 2000s, at the European headquarters, especially at the European Commission level, there have been a lot of initiatives to improve and increase relationships with Russia in the energy field. The energy dialogue was launched together between the European Commission representatives and representatives of Russia's energy ministry. There have obviously been a number of contentious issues back at that time, but is rather normal. We also have contentious issues between France and Germany regarding, for example, nuclear energy development in Europe, or between France and the United Kingdom about fishery, between the European Union and the United States on a number of topics related to trade. Many in Russia back that time wanted to be part of this larger international family, not especially European family, but let's say to be an international player with specific understandings of their interests, to defend those interests, but to be part of the game, let's say like that. There was even a multilateral institution which have existed since 1994, the Energy Charter Treaty, which was concluded by all the former Soviet Union countries, all the European Union members, including those countries who have joined the European Union later, or those who aspire to the European Union today. Even the Energy Charter, which seems to be nowadays a half-dead organization, received a certain impetus in negotiation process. There have been a transit protocol which aimed at improving gas relations. Not only gas relations, actually transit protocol was way broader, but naturally the focus was on natural gas, to create a stable governance between Russia, European Union, and those countries who are in between, including Ukraine, among others. What we have observed since maybe early 2000s, or maybe towards the end of the decade of the 21st century, is that a certain revanchist mood started to develop in Russia. And maybe since 2008, when we remember the Georgian events in summer 2008, when a large part of Russian political elite started to consider themselves as strongly different from the West. They were not willing anymore to be part of this international community with defending Russia's interests. For them, the important point was to put under question the foundations of the post-Cold War norms and institutions that existed. Therefore, Russia's approach towards the Energy Charter has changed in 2009, and then finally, a little bit later, Russia even withdrew from the Energy Charter Treaty. And before that, it has proposed its own alternative, a draft convention on energy security, which somehow shows that Russian government, Russian political elites in general, wanted to see an alternative to the post-Cold War institutions. And coming back to Europe, imagine that European Union member states, particularly Germany, relied on the old partnership with Russia, increased their interdependency with Russia, without understanding that Russian political context has been changing. What happened actually is that big European economies became more dependent on Russia in terms of natural gas trade. And there have been an expectation that we are talking to a partner with whom we can discuss. In the meantime, a revanchist mood in Russia created a context in which the reliability is now under question. Many now accuse Germany of being over-reliant on Russia. But Germany thought, first of all, about its economic interests, which were in line with what has been happening since basically early 1980s. And maybe part of the German political class haven't noticed the revanchist mood which was brewing in Russia.
Yeah, that. Thank you for sharing that context. I think oftentimes Germany is quite prevalent when we're thinking about European dependency on Russian energy sources and like the Nord Stream 2 pipeline and the kind of controversy surrounding that comes to mind as well. So it is interesting to hear that context of not noticing perhaps the revanchism that is happening in Moscow. Today, we are in a difficult situation with the war in Ukraine, and I wonder what the energy context looks like now. I'm thinking also of those recent gas interruptions and sanctions, and I wonder if you can explain a little bit of that context.
Definitely, your second question follows the first, because indeed, once the geopolitical situation changes, then what do we do? Finally, in February 2022, the world noticed that there is a revanchist trend surrounding Russian political elite, let's say like this, surrounding the decision-making. And there have been an immediate reaction saying that, look, we should not purchase oil, gas, and coal from Russia. But it's way more difficult than it might actually seem to be. European Union imports about 40% of coal from Russia. Most of the mines that existed in the European Union have been closed. The coal industry has been in decline in terms of production. Many in Europe since early 2000s expected and even hoped that coal industry will go away from the European landscape. I remember back to 2004, one of European experts in energy policies told, don't worry, coal will not die in the next 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 decades. And I dared to repeat him, his words, in 2020. What do we see now? We see demand for coal increasing, but capacities, European capacities to reproduce coal have been declining. Russia is an important supplier of coal to Europe. But at the end of the day, coal industry can be adapted. You can import coal from anywhere in the world because it's a product that is easy to ship. The logistics of coal are really easy. In oil, it becomes more difficult. When you look at the map of the European Union, most of the European Union member states increased their import dependency on oil since the early 2000s. Quite interestingly, three major economies, Germany, France, and Italy, have actually decreased their reliance on Russian oil. But when you look elsewhere across Europe, the trend has been the other way around, particularly in Eastern and Central Europe and the Baltic states. So you can imagine why some of the Central European states, such as Hungary, have been extremely reluctant on making any major moves to step away from Russian oil because they have been over-reliant on it. Even the Baltic states, who have been quite solidar with Ukraine and politically wished to get out of Russian oil and oil products, found a number of issues, including the dependence of ports, harbors, on oil and oil products transit. And that basically involves all the local economy with it. So reducing dependence on Russian oil is actually a challenge. It's also a big challenge because internationally, there are no major countries that can replace volumes that Russia supplies to Europe. There are three states that can do it jointly in the short-term run. They are Iraq, Iran, and Libya. Two of them, namely Iraq and Libya, pass through very difficult institutional problems, political conflicts. Iran has an entirely different set of problems related to the sanctions imposed on Iran because of the attempt to develop a nuclear program in Iran. And there is a group of countries who supervise Iran, and they, 6+1 so-called group, and that includes Russia. Ironically, Russia can even block the Iranian deal, let's say like this, and block Iran's entrance into the world market. And if, for example, the West decides to open Iran without having an agreement within the G6+1 group, then in this case, the problem is the reliability of the West, because it would look like you are releasing a prisoner to help you that this prisoner catches another criminal. Yeah, you cannot close Russia by opening up Iran. Gas is the third sector, which is the most complicated of the three, because gas has been mostly connected to the natural gas grids. Yes, in the last decades, liquefied natural gas shipped by tankers, by LNG tankers, have been developed. But the share of the liquefied natural gas remains smaller, at least for Europe, than what is going on with the piped gas, with the gas connected to the networks. So for Europe to diversify from Russian gas, one needs to see additional volumes of liquefied natural gas, of LNG. But there is a strong competition for LNG, particularly from Asia. Asians would like to switch from coal to gas, and therefore they import LNG. And most of LNG that actually is traded around the world has been contracted for a number of years. So for Europe, it becomes difficult to find alternative available LNG that would replace Russian gas.
So yeah, this is quite complicated then, that not only the logistics, but also the political will behind it and the values-based sort of policy that you mentioned. Well, you know, we're talking about coal, oil, natural gas, which are these conventional, I suppose we could say, energy sources. But for a long time now, you know, we had this climate crisis and pressure to turn toward green energy. And I wonder, what does the situation now look like for the advancement of green energy in Europe?
It's a very interesting and tricky question. Indeed, back to 2019, the European Union announced a European Green Deal, which consists of making the European continent climate neutral by 2050. What does it mean, climate neutral? Climate neutrality means that you cannot emit more of greenhouse gases compared to what nature can absorb. And this requires a drastic reduction of fossil fuel consumption. That includes all the three sectors that we have discussed, coal, oil, and gas. It's a very tricky and difficult challenge that the European Union took, because in order to accomplish this objective, it would need to increase the level of electrification across the European economic sectors. And within this electricity consumption that would be bigger than now, carbon neutral energies would need to provide sources to the electricity supply. To give you figures about it, currently, direct consumption of electricity in the European Union is about 21%. To achieve a meaningful electrification, you would need to have about 75% of electrification, three times more than now, more than three times. That would also imply a bigger number of capacity installed. Of course, theoretically, you can do it with nuclear energy, but nuclear energy has its own list of problems related to nuclear safety and to nuclear waste management. Then the only alternative becomes the renewable energies. Apart of large hydro, most of renewable energies are intermittent. They depend on weather. And the problem is that when renewable energies operate, a backup energy has to be there somewhere. And there are only two sources that can provide backup energy. There are either coal or natural gas. What happened over the last years in the rush to decrease greenhouse gas emissions, most of the member states reduced the coal consumption and increased the dependence on natural gas. And that implies dependence on Russian natural gas, which constitutes up to 40% of all the supplies of natural gas across the European Union. And that's one of the reasons why Germany advocated for the Nord Stream 2, because it would increase the share of natural gas and would replace coal that Germany committed to replace over the rush to the climate neutrality.
So again, we're in this sticky situation where in this effort to develop greener energy, the reliance on Russia increased in order to sub out the coal. Difficult path forward, perhaps, then.
It's interesting also to note that, first of all, it seems that the European Union has overestimated itself in the global emission structure. European Union contributes solely to 8% of global greenhouse gas emissions. Russia contributes to 4%. And now with the war in Ukraine, the emissions that we may observe, not talking even about all the humanitarian crisis, only about environmental impact, will annihilate all the European efforts in the pathway towards the climate neutrality. And finally, very often in the European Union, people think that they must have this natural gas instead of coal. But they forget that if they deprive Asian states from liquefied natural gas, then Asian states like China and India, the world's biggest or fast-growing emitters, let's say like this, will use coal, and that will give a way more damaging effect to the global climate neutrality. Because there is no continental climate neutrality. Climate neutrality can be only global.
Right, right. We don't live in an environment that is solely contained to our country or our political bloc. That is an important point to make too. You know, I wonder if we can think a little bit about the future of energy or energy independence for the Baltic states in particular. This is something that, you know, has been in the minds for a long time. And as we've seen the sort of political solidarity for Ukraine in this moment, something that has been kind of on the tip of the tongue for many politicians, decoupling from Russian energy sources. But I think that the reality is quite more complex, and I wonder where you see that future going.
Well, I'm quite optimistic about Baltic states. You remember that about 10 years ago, the three Baltic states were considered to be an energy island because most of their infrastructure have been related rather to Russia rather than to the rest of the European Union. It has changed since. The three Baltic states became way more resilient in terms of market, but still with a major share of Russian energy in the market. We have lived through this market paradigm when markets, competitive markets, ensured security of supply as well. I have written it back to 2019, 3 years ago, in a study for the International Center for Defense and Security of Estonia, saying that the better market functions, the more you are resilient in terms of energy security. However, the situation becomes different once you need to get away of the dependence on the physical volumes, because what market ensures? Market ensures that despite physical volumes that arrive to your country, you are resilient enough to ensure the market functioning. Like, for example, when you fill petrol into your car, you never think about where these molecules of petrol of hydrocarbons come from. It can be Saudi Arabia, Nigeria. You don't care because market functions. Here in this case, you have to disrupt the market by removing physical flows from Russia. And that becomes way more difficult. And therefore, the European Commission will consider different ways of how to help the three Baltic states in finding an alternative way. It's very tricky. Let's say in terms of oil supplies, one may find an alternative, which will be more expensive probably than Russian oil supplies. But still, physically, it's feasible. For natural gas, it becomes more difficult because you have to have liquefied natural gas arriving to the Baltic states. But there are not a lot of liquefied natural gas available. Yes, there are some discussions of opening new LNG terminals, but where the liquefied natural gas will come from? Lithuania, back to 2014, opened its own LNG terminal called Independence. But up to 20% of the LNG which come to Lithuania is from Russia, from Novatek. In Estonia, there are also LNG coming from the other side of the border, from the Pskov region, Pihva region of Russia, by trucks. LNG which serves ship navigation operated by Tallink comes from Russia. So it's very tricky, because switching to alternative sources implies intervention into the market and implies the willingness to pay of the societies to be willing basically to contribute more to this diversification. So far, we can see declarations by people, by politicians, even by public saying that yes, they are ready. But whether you are ready or not will be decided by the bill you are having at the end. I'm still quite optimistic. I think in the midterm run, it will happen. It will not happen immediately.
Right. There needs to be the political will, the actual physical ability to replace those sources, and not to mention the will of the populace to pay the higher prices.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I'm a little bit curious about the role of ownership in energy companies. I'm thinking specifically about Latvijas Gas, where there's quite a significant ownership stake from Gazprom. And I wonder how that factors in.
Indeed, Gazprom has about 30%, 30 plus percent in Latvijas Gas. At the same time, Gazprom is the major supplier of natural gas into Latvian underground storage in Inčukalns next to Riga. And is the biggest actually underground storage in the region and one of the biggest in Europe, is actually a guarantee for the security of supply. And now, as you know, Gazprom interrupted natural gas supplies to Finland. So where do they get gas from? They get it from Latvia. Is a physical volume which comes ultimately from Russia, but now is directed to Finland because of the emergency and because of the interconnections which have been built between Estonia and Finland. Where the ownership can play is in the decisions on whether to follow new gas rules imposed by Russian government, by Russian authorities on gas trade. As you know, back to April this year, Russian authorities require to pay natural gas to a specific account in Gazprom Bank. And then this account will convert automatically the amount into rubles. Not many companies were happy to do so because it exposes them to the foreign exchange rate. Some companies apparently agreed. At least Moscow declares that a number of European customers have already agreed to pay according to the new rule. However, not a single confirmation from European counterparts is there to either confirm or deny this claim. It can be that European companies agree to pay this way. Note that the European Commission explicitly mentioned that paying via this mode of payment does not violate sanctions imposed on Russian banks. However, changing rules of the game during the trade should normally imply the consent of both parties who have agreed to conduct the transactions. And according to the principle of sanctity of contracts, a supplier cannot interrupt supplies in case if a dispute arises. For example, the Finnish company Gazum rejected the mode of payments in accordance to the Russian mode and demanded an arbitration about the issue. Logically, until the end of the arbitral process, Russia shouldn't have interrupted gas supplies. However, it did happen. The very principle of the sanctity of contracts have been practically violated by Russian suppliers. And that enters into overall logic of the current mind in the Russian Federation, who want to put under questions all the institutions, including the very legal principles that actually exist. So that basically drives us to a very important question, whether in a rush to find an alternative to Russian gas, some EU member states might be even forced to do so because Russia will or has been already interrupt or interrupting natural gas flows to these countries. We have three member states to whom gas flows have been interrupted. Namely, there are Finland, as I mentioned already, then Bulgaria and Poland. Quite interestingly, both Bulgaria and Poland have declared that they're not going to renew contracts with Gazprom after 2022. So we could imagine that Gazprom has been rather ready to interrupt supplies to these two countries. That basically could be a political game related to the. It remains still unclear whether Russia can afford interrupting supplies to bigger member states like France, Germany, or Italy. It's still a question. I think there is a political readiness to do so, but there is no evidence that is going to happen. Finally, regarding the issue of ownership, it is quite tricky. Latvia, I think, will remain a player who will abide to Moscow's rules. I might be wrong, I don't make big declarations, but it seems like they will do it. They will play a bit of a bad guy, but this way they will ensure that the underground storage is there to supply gas to other member states in the situation of difficulty, and that includes Finland. However, this question of ownership does not guarantee everything. We have seen that German former subsidiaries of Gazprom, Gazprom Germania, tried to pay in accordance to the Russian payment method, and Russia has rejected them. So there is no guarantee that Russia will not go till the end in terms of interrupting gas supplies. At least what happens is that Russia keeps the pressure at the maximal level in order to stimulate instability in the European gas markets.
Just layer after layer of complexity then in this effort to decouple or to diversify or to make the market more resilient. Well, Dr. Belli, I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me and for sharing your insights on what is a very complicated subject.
It's an extremely interesting subject as well. I always recommend a book by Fadil Chalabi called Oil Policies and Oil Myths, where he described his own biography. And back to 1950s, he was invited to work in the oil ministry of Iraq. And he didn't want at the beginning. His specialization was different. But the person who tried to engage him told him, once you are in the energy sector, it becomes so interesting, so you will never be willing to get out of it. And Chalabi confesses that this person was right. And I think we feel that Chalabi was right as well.
Well, we will link that into the bottom of our episode description, and perhaps we will have some new energy scholars to come out of this. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, likewise.
Thank you for tuning in to Baltic Ways, a podcast from the Association for the Advancement of Baltic Studies, produced in partnership with the Baltic Initiative at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. A note that the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the authors and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of AABS or FPRI. I'm your host, Dr. Indra Ekmanis. Subscribe to our newsletters at aabs-balticstudies.org and fpri.org/baltic-initiative for more from the world of Baltic studies. Thanks for listening. See you next time.